We cover many serious issues in this podcast. This discussion may contain reference to domestic violence, sexual violence, violence against children, suicide, drug use, or graphic depictions of death or dead bodies. It is not suitable for all audiences.
Tonight on Unsolved Mysteries Rewind, two friends get together to discuss episodes of their favorite television show, Unsolved Mysteries. Will they find answers? Will anyone care? You may be able to solve a mystery.
Hello, this is Mark, and you are listening to Unsolved Mysteries Rewind. I am on with my co-host, Kim. How are you, Kim?
Oh, I am great. Thank you. How are you?
I'm doing really well. As we jump into not only an exciting time for Unsolved Mysteries in general, but also an exciting time because the episode we are talking about today is Season 10, Episode 2.
Mm-hmm.
This episode is a very strange one. It's one of these ones where it kind of goes into the world of the paranormal. It also goes into the world of murder and just truly unexplained things. So that's what kind of called out to me. And thanks to your investigative work, you've pulled out things that I could never have imagined existed.
Oh, I'm so excited when we get to the juicy one. But we do start with Brooke Baker. This is a pretty well-known unsolved mysteries case, Brooke Baker. This is September 7th, 1997. College student, 19-year-old Brooke Baker is found raped and stabbed to death in her off-campus apartment.
Now, do you think that this is a little bit of a cautionary tale?
In
I just
a
feel like she would have went
way,
to the police. Yeah. Oh, thanks.
No.
I just feel as though I hate it because it's hard for me to judge this particular story without sounding a little bit sexist. But she should have gone to the police at some point.
Yeah, but lest we forget, one of the big creepers, could he have done it, is a police guy.
Campus police.
Yeah, but maybe she didn't feel right.
That's true. You're right.
So we'll jump right in, and I'm sure we'll get into it. But we meet Janet Baker, who's Brooke's mom, and she is like intense, and she should be. I mean, her daughter was raped and murdered, so she's like, I will not rest until I find who did this.
Good. You know, it's like, but it's tragic because she was probably nothing like this before this happened.
Oh, I know. It's obviously taken a toll on her. So Brooke is very active in the school paper, which is called the Trailblazer. And Robert Stack says, quote, she made sure everyone knew it, which I don't know what that means.
Yeah, I don't know. I made a note saying I don't know if it means that she was just a badass reporter, which I can totally respect, or she was just kind of annoying and in everybody's like face.
I feel like he probably meant it both ways.
Yeah.
So in the spring of 1997, she actually heard about a date rape happening at a frat party, which I'm sure happens a lot. And she went after it very aggressively. So You go, girl. Her mom said that she feared for her safety in investigating it. But she said, you know, if I can stop one girl in the future from getting raped, then it's worth what I'm doing.
Right. So, I mean, definitely she leans to the side of badass. She's willing to put herself in a compromising position with really shady ass people to get not just the story, but to actually bring people to justice, maybe.
Absolutely. I love her. I do too. And I thought she was tenacious. And I think that this whole thing is like, see what happens, ladies, when you forget your place and you get too tenacious, then everybody wants to murder you. You know, so that's the sexist aspect of it. And I got into like a feminist rage in this episode.
Well, and it's a triggering episode when it comes to that type of thing, because it really speaks of a period of time that kind of still exists. And what do you think of frats? I mean, were you ever in a frat?
No. Well, I'm a woman, but
no, but there are female. No. There are fraternities that are all female. Well, in the schools
sororities?
I went to. Yeah, it's the same thing. I mean, it's just another word. You know, sorority in my eyes is the same thing as a fraternity.
Okay. Well, yeah, fair enough. But no, I wasn't ever in a fraternity or a sorority. I went to culinary school, so I didn't go to like one of these types of schools. I was never like, oh yeah, let's all hang out together. Like, I've always kind of hated people.
Yeah, and so I was approached, and it was one of these things where it was like, no, like I don't know. It was just, I don't understand, but this culture does exist. I mean, a lot of people say rape culture doesn't exist and fraternity culture doesn't exist. And it's kind of like you're really blind to it, or maybe you're scared of it because maybe your kid's going away to school next year or something, but it's one of those things that does exist. And I mean, personally, it doesn't really appeal to me, because if I want to have a drink, I'm just going to have a drink. I don't need to have 3 gallons of drink.
Yeah, no, frats are the worst.
Yes.
Totally. So they get really pissed that she's writing this story and exposing them for raping people. So they start sending her emails threatening her if she ran the story, like, if you don't shut your mouth, we're going to permanently shut it for you, like stuff like that. And so one day she is minding her own business and a truckload of fraternity brothers confronts her at her friend's house. Yeah. And they're just like, if you run this story, blah, blah, blah. So all these men are confronting this woman, this young woman at her friend's house and just threatening her. It is so outrageous.
The reenactment is very scary. I definitely, I think it's like this a cult almost. It's horrifying to see a group of people yelling at one person in general, but to have this girl being yelled at by a group of men, it's horrifying. And I think they really conveyed it very well. And I am going to say that this, without a doubt, happened and happens.
Oh yeah. And they actually pull up in the reenactment in the back of like a pickup truck. And it looks like the only thing they're missing is like pitchforks and torches and stuff like that. It's crazy. So actually I did a little digging. I think that this was at the dormitories. Like, I think this was Brooke's place at her dorm, but that's the reason why she had to move.
So she had to move out of the dorms to off campus.
Yeah. But just because she didn't feel safe. And she is like right in the heart of college and frats and all this kind of stuff when you're in a dormitory. So she moves just very slightly off campus.
Yeah.
And the freaking landlord is putting the creeps on her now. Ugh, it made me angry. It just like Jody Huizentruit, where it's like there is 15 people that could be the suspect because she is a beautiful woman and everybody wanted to take something from her. Like, that's what makes me angry.
Yeah, like, I just didn't, and she wasn't making friends like that. I mean, not to say she didn't have friends, but what she did was kind of really, I think, on the side of also being very controversial. And people were kind of, like, threatening her at parties, but she still had the balls to go to them, and or not really the balls, but she just wanted to, you know, live her life and wasn't going to stop her. And
yeah, good for her.
It was really one of these things where, yeah, I mean, we might have somebody completely off the radar that we don't even know about, because who knows? I mean, but this guy is certainly a candidate for not only overstepping and breaking so many laws. There are renters' rights. There are I've rented properties to people. I've rented properties from people. You cannot do these things.
Yeah, so she would, like, come home from a party, and he would be in her house, and he would just be like, oh, I was looking for my bug spray. And she's like, get out of here, you weirdo.
I had, like, to laugh, because it was like, he's such a prowler and a creeper. Imagine walking into your house, ugh, and your landlord's sitting on your couch, or whatever.
So nasty. Probably, like, going through her drawers and stuff. Like, I hate him. He would come over all the time and confront her about having other men over, and it's like, it's her house, A, and B, she's an adult, and you're not her boyfriend. Like, what do you care if she has men over? I felt so bad for her. But also, talk about the pool of suspects. She had recently placed an ad in the campus newspaper looking for a roommate. And they show the ad, and it just says, like, come on over. You know, if I'm not home, come back again. Like, just come straight to my house.
Three knocks. It's the code. And it's very strange. Again, this is the mid to late 90s. There's a lot more trust. The internet was new, but at the same time, people still use classifieds and stuff like that. I remember going over to a guy's house to buy a really high-end piece of audio gear, and the guy's address was right in the ad, and I went there. You know, it wasn't – the guy could have killed me for all I know, or I could have killed him. I didn't.
Yeah, or he could have been robbed, saying, I got all this expensive stuff at this address.
Hey, hold on. Elaine's right down the time, and then I have to take that out. I'm just kidding.
Oh.
I didn't rob anyone. I didn't kill anyone. So, no, but yeah, I mean, especially here in New York, these ads, you know, you would have the Long Island Ear and all that kind of stuff, these newspapers, and it would just be people posting their addresses. And it's a very weird period of time. It wasn't uncommon to do those things, especially on campuses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So back to Brooke's like dead body, sadly, there is some DNA left behind. She had been raped, so there was semen and there was skin under her fingernails.
Yeah.
So they tested 52 people against the DNA and there were no matches. And she was only stabbed to death half a block from the campus. So that's kind of where we leave Unsolved Mysteries, but there is an update.
Okay. 52 people, though. I mean, I can't say that the police didn't try to find somebody. Right?
Oh, yeah. No, they were trying. They were. That's a whole lot of people. And like we said before, the suspect pool is so big.
Mm.
So on July 5th, 1999, police are actually searching the apartment of missing Vincent's college student, Erica Elaine Norman. And they realize this crime scene looks familiar. It's pretty identical to Brooks, including the fact that there was water running in the bathtub. I guess that was like his calling card.
Oh, I hate it.
Oh, I know. So
I hate calling cards. It just makes it even more creepy.
Yeah, and this guy thinks he's like a budding serial killer.
Well, he got away with it already. Who knows if he did it? I'm sure he's done it other times.
Or at least some kind of escalation. So Erica was actually last seen leaving a restaurant with a man named Brian Edward Jones. And interesting fact about Brian, he was actually roommates with a man that Brooke was seeing before her death. And he had been over to her house before. And he was actually on the night of the murder at a frat party two blocks away. The next day after Brooke is murdered, he has a huge scratch down his face.
Mm.
I don't know why nobody thought to test him, but whatever. I mean, I'm not a police officer. So they took his DNA and it matched. And Erica, the second girl's body, was found 2 weeks later in a cornfield in a plastic tub.
Oh, my God.
So he said he would admit to killing her in exchange for taking the death penalty off the table. And on December 14th, 1999, he is sentenced to life without the possibility of parole for Brooke's rape and murder and another 60 years for Erica's murder. So... Oh, yeah,
it's good that he's arrested and it's good that he's in prison for the rest of his life. But, you know, he got away with it. It's heartbreaking.
He got away with it for 2 years. Yeah. So the only motive that police could come up with was the fact that he wanted to commit murder after viewing a crime thriller in 1996 called Curdled. I guess that shows a woman being like knife attacked and stabbed multiple times with a kitchen knife. And then it's like left running in the sink, like there's running water. So they think that's what it was. I can't find an updated picture of him to save my life. The only thing I have is his booking thing, but he is still in prison. I checked just this morning.
Hmm. I mean, it's I never heard of this movie. Thank God.
It says Quentin Tarantino presents, but he only wrote like a small part of it.
Hmm. Presents usually just means he threw like some money at it, maybe.
Yeah.
But still, you know, it doesn't even make a difference, you know, who made the movie, because to be inspired by something like that to do such a heinous act is there's mental illness. You know, it's disgusting.
Oh, yeah. Oh, something is already broken if you see a movie and you are like, I want to emulate that. You know, like they say with natural born killers, like that's all these serial killers' favorite movie. And it's like, well, you know, I mean, there was already something off.
Yeah, and this was also, now that I think about it, the period of time where the movies were, like, kind of ultra-violent.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't say I'm going to blame movies.
No, I know. Yeah, totally.
But it's interesting. Maybe he had this movie, maybe in his DVD player. I'm not really sure how they came to this conclusion.
Oh, he rented it. Like, they had the rental receipts and stuff of it, like, right before, and I guess it's pretty similar.
You rent a movie? What's that's weird. So yeah, it's very strange, very strange. But now we're going to talk about something in the paranormal. You know, now
loved this story so much.
Did you really?
I loved it.
Now I do want to just reference that I did an interview with a walk-in. Do you want to say what a walk-in is?
Okay, so a walk-in is basically a person on earth has a near-death experience, and in that time that like the spirit world is kind of open, another spirit comes in and takes the place of your spirit.
Yeah.
So your soul leaves your body and a new soul comes in.
Yeah, it's almost like the spirit, the one that leaves the body, dies. It goes to, you know, heaven or wherever. And it's, you know, you literally get this replacement of spirit. And it's a willful act. It's one of these things. So I interviewed this woman, Hildegard Gminer, or Miner. And she's a walk-in. She claims from the Boots Andromeda part of the galaxy. And I'll put a link to that in the show notes if people want to listen. Now, Hildegard is a really, really wonderful person. But she falls into this category of being very kind of hippy-dippy. And but if you if you could listen to her, I don't know if you're going to take the time to do this, but if you listen to her, just dispel any type of preconceived notion that she's making it up. Because I spoke to this woman for a really long time, and at least I believe that she believes what she's saying is factual.
And I have to say, I think you have to be a little hippy-dippy to believe in the premise of this. You could otherwise explain it away. But every single walk-in that they interviewed was, like, happy about the experience. Like, it seemed like a very positive thing in their life.
Yeah, and I've spoken to a couple of walk-ins. And, you know, one person went through this particular situation, and she now knows all of this really advanced math, and it's legitimate math, and it's crazy.
That's so cool.
And I say it's crazy because I've said to her it's crazy, and she's like, I agree with you, it's crazy. She created this mathematical, physical equation that is just boggling people, and I'll send you a link to that and see what you think of that. But in order to even conceive what she was talking about, she went to all these mathematicians and they created this 3D model of what she's talking about. And it's kind of a really kind of beautiful design. But anyway,
that's incredible.
Right. And her name, she goes by the name Aurora. And I also interviewed her. She's very nice. And she also falls into this category of somebody who maybe I would have known in the past who burns incense while they record podcasts.
So. Yeah.
But I no longer have a dashiki, nor can I fit in one. So walk-ins, you know, we have to have this whole thing. Now, when we introduce the walk-ins, he's talking about a number of people, and he references a number, Robert Stack references a number of stories that have been used in the past. And I don't know if you caught that. He talked about a person being, hit by lightning and electrocuted.
Yes. And I pulled the gif of that because that was insane.
So this is somebody, Danny and Brinkley, who I interviewed on the odd, who was electrocuted twice. I believe he's in a plane crash. He went through all of these near-death experiences. He's not a walk-in. That's why I was very surprised to see him in this. But he went through near-death experiences. And even today, I just texted him like a few days ago. He deals with hospice patients now. And he's honestly the nicest guy in the universe.
Nice.
He's a little bit older now, so that's why I kind of was checking in on him every once in a while because of the whole coronavirus and everything, and he really puts himself in situations where he's around a lot of sick people. But anyway, he's doing well still, Denny and Brinkley. He's very eye-opening, really, really wonderful person, and he's got that little bit of a Southern drawl, and you'd like him.
Sounds like it. Yeah. That's awesome.
But he used to be a bully, and that was the whole thing. Yeah. He was a real dick, actually, and he went through this near-death experience, and he decided to turn his life around. But that's not the story we're talking about.
No, they give us a few examples of how a near-death experience can make you a different person, but these people actually are different people, is kind of the point that they were making.
Yeah.
So we get to meet Reverend Carol E. Parrish, who is just the most lovely woman I've ever seen.
Yes.
I just think she's amazing. So in 1958, she was like a little 50s housewife, pregnant with her sixth child. And during childbirth, because it was so difficult, they gave her a shot of sodium pentothal, which is actually what they used to euthanize pets. So she ends up going into anaphylactic shock and her lungs collapse. And she says at that moment, her soul completely left her body. She had an out-of-body experience, and she just like watched her baby being born.
Yeah.
And then she entered through this tunnel of light. So she wasn't expected to live, but she says that a new soul entered her body. So ever since then, and she kind of cries thinking about how will like people believe me, like I sound crazy, but she begins having more out of body experiences. And once she's aware of it, like her two halves combine.
Yeah.
Which we'll post a GIF of because it was like very visual. So her 50s husband is like, you're crazy.
He literally says, you're crazy.
Yeah. And she's like, oh, I just became more assertive and independent. So yeah, in the 50s, that makes a lady crazy.
Yeah.
And her husband left her in 1967.
Oh, so God. What a weakling.
I know.
I mean, who knows? Maybe it was something else. But I mean, like, just because your wife has an opinion is no reason to leave. I know. Jesus.
So in 1965, she begins to study metaphysical religion. And she's remarried. She is very happy. Like, I think she is just doing fine.
Yeah, me too.
And then we get to meet Sherry. Now, this is the riskiest unsolved mystery.
If I could just mention one thing. When she shows the separation of her body and everything going in, this is a really, really good visual if you want to learn what astral projection is all about. I don't know if people listening to the show have any interest in these type of metaphysics or that's just a Gardner truck. It's not a Hummer in the background. Just a gardener driving by. So, but the world of parapsychology and metaphysics, it can be very, very hard to get a visual of what the hell you're talking about. But if you wanted to learn more about astral projection, it's this is a really good visual presentation of what it is. Even though she's talking about it a little bit differently, I just think that it really hit the nail on the head if people are trying to understand.
And there will be a GIF on the Facebook page, Unsolved Mysteries Rewind Podcast.
A lot of good effects here, by the way.
Yeah.
And we have almost a naked lady in this.
Yeah, you almost see everything. So Sherry is staying with a friend and her like chakra's kind of off. Like she's just not feeling it. So her friend is a metaphysical healer and she asked her to give her like a rub down. So she's naked under a sheet.
Just it's funny the way you say that. Rub down, you know. But yeah,
So she's in the room and they said the whole room changed and this globe of energy came and they're describing it as like a literal ball of light comes in.
Like ball lightning in the room.
Exactly. And you better believe I pulled this GIF and it'll be on the Facebook page. So it like goes into her spine. Her spine fills all the way up like whoop. And then she gets up and she is like this naked orb of light and she is just like dancing with it and like it looked very like Burning Man, like delightful. I wanted to do that.
This whole segment was because I'm going to guarantee it was because they got an intern right out of film school who's like, I have this cool software.
Oh my god, probably. and a woman willing to do like almost total nudity. You could tell she was wearing like a nude leotard, but it was pretty scandalous.
Yeah. My wife was like, you could see her breasts. I'm like, wow.
Yeah. She was laying down, you could definitely see some side boob.
It's like if you're 12 years old, you might really enjoy this a little bit more than we did.
Yeah, I think probably so. So she tells husband Donovan that she is no longer Sherry. She is Jewel.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. And he was like, she definitely changed because when I barked at her to go get me stuff, like she wouldn't do it anymore. Again, so I knew she was a different person.
It's like, you know, honestly, it's like, what is with these guys? If I told my wife, blah, 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 I mean, I don't know. Maybe I'm just more modern than these people, but you just don't talk to people this way, no matter who they are.
Yeah, he was like, she wasn't as subservient to me anymore, so I think something did happen to her. But she would basically, like, go into the grocery store, and she had, like, such a hypersensitivity to energy fields and to people, to things that, like, she would be, in her mind, it would have all these, like, thoughts and feelings and auras and stuff projected into her mind, and it would totally overload her.
And this is something that also, it's a phenomenon that happened. We talked a little bit in the last episode about EMPs, electrical magnetic pulses. But some people are just much more sensitive. Some people will have their cell phone on them, and their battery will drain more than other people because their body actually will drain the power, literally. Wow. I don't know why, but it has something to do with like your own personal magnetic fields and your own. You know, I can go deeper into that, but I'm not going to.
Okay. everybody in the family seems pretty happy about the new soul. I've looked them all up and they are all doing like conferences about walk-ins and, what do you call it? Like self-help guided type experiences. And adorable Reverend Carol Parrish is still around. She is 85 years old. She's written many books about walk-ins, and Jewel has a book called Walk-ins.
Yeah, I mean, and walk-ins, I think, are the next thing that people are going to talk about. This is one of these kind of untapped things. I'm kind of curious. Paranormal stuff kind of comes and goes, and this is one of those ones that people very often don't hear about.
Oh, I loved it. I thought it was a cool idea, a cool story. They were talking about, like, when you go to the other side, how you are just wrapped in understanding and wisdom and all the knowledge of the year. I was just like, yes, I want to do that.
Yeah, I'll do that.
Sign me up.
So now we head down to Vider for another beautiful young lady and another tragic story.
Yeah, and an interesting side note, when I started researching this, this actually is the case that inspired the movie Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri.
Never heard of it. My wife did. I don't
really
know.
Oh, my God. It was like winning all the Golden Globes and stuff a few years ago. Sam Rockwell.
I'm going to look for it. It's such a long title, though. I mean,
yeah, I know, but I think it's like an indie vibe. So,
Totally off my radar, but it's something I'm going to look into.
I don't think the actual case itself within that story has anything to do with it, but it's definitely inspired by actions taken after the murder. So police find Lucille Catherine Cathy Page in a wrecked car. The weird thing is she's dead, but the weird thing is she has no obvious wounds. The car had no damage, and the impact was so slight that she still has soft drinks full upright in her seat.
Like, she came to a stop at 5 miles per hour, you know?
At the absolute fastest, yeah. But what's weird is, though, like, her feet were tucked back towards the seat and not stretched out towards the pedals. And she was also missing socks that she was wearing earlier that night. She wasn't wearing a seatbelt, but she wasn't slumped over the dashboard. She was still, like, sitting far back in her seat. And there were blades of grass under her body, which had indicated to police that she had been dragged and placed in the car. Now, we meet Detective Sergeant Ray Mosley, and he says the accident was staged, which, A, obviously. B, fun fact, he was actually charged in 2014 for stealing a taser from a crime scene.
Holy cow.
Yeah, I found that this point. I was like, the juicy, I am adding this.
Now, was he dismissed? Or
yes.
Wow. For stealing a taser? Well, he's stealing something that is evidence, right?
I didn't think about that, but just being in somebody's house and then being like, that's mine now because I'm the law, like, that enough to be dismissed, I would say.
I would, you know, just knowing a lot of cops and the way they are, I would not think that that is enough to get fired. I really just don't. I'm not saying I agree with it, but
yeah,
I'm guessing that this person stole something that was part of evidence.
And there is a lot of shady stuff going on around this guy because apparently he is, quote, a lifelong friend of Steve Page, who is the husband of the victim.
So, innocent, right? I mean, this guy.
I know. Exactly. I
don't think he did it.
Well, maybe I'll change your mind. So Cathy Page was a 34-year-old married mother of two, and she lived only 100 yards from the crash site. And police said when they went to go wake her husband Steve up and tell him that she was dead, he immediately looked down the road to where the car was, almost like he knew.
Yeah, that was a bit shady.
Yeah, and Detective Mosley said he was crying, but there was never any tears. So Steve is the main suspect, as you know, usually the husband is, and he insists that he's innocent, and we get to have him talking to Unsolved Mysteries.
One question. Now, Mosley was saying that when he said that his wife was found down the road or and he looked down there. I mean, he admitted that Steve had done this.
That he had looked, exactly. And he's the one that told us that Steve never cried actual tears. Mm. So this is all from Mosley. So I don't know.
Which is weird. Maybe they were friendly or something like that, but it doesn't really sound like he's on his side because these are observations that easily could have been left out.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and we get some info from Mosley, but still, I don't know. Well, we'll see. So Cathy and Steve had actually been married for 13 years, and he said that they drifted apart so she could find herself, you know.
Yeah.
And Cathy's sister says,
basically, I mean, that's.
Yeah.
We see this also time and time again.
Yeah. See our Jewel and Dottie Kaler case where anytime the husband is just like talking bad about his missing or dead wife, like, maybe let's take a closer look at him. That is so unusual. So. Cathy's sister says that she was done with the marriage. It was very abusive, and Steve had actually moved out at the time of this. So the next day, Cathy asked him to babysit the kids. She was like, hey, I'm going to go out with my friend Charlotte. We're going to have some drinks. It's going to be like 11:15. The kids are going to be asleep. Come over. Just be a body here, basically, while the kids are sleeping, and I'll go out with my friends.
And you made a great point that, you know, it's kind of like, you know, you one, you should have never have an issue watching your own children, right? Mm-hmm. But it's not babysitting when it's you're the father. This
That's
is
like
your
a huge pain.
Duty. Like you're there. It's like if anything, she's just letting him know that he needs to be there.
Exactly. No, that was like a huge pet peeve of mine. It is not babysitting when you're the dad. So she was getting ready to go out with a friend, Charlotte. She had just popped out of the shower, according to Steve, when Steve had arrived. And he says that she went at like 11:15, 11:30 at night to head to Beaumont. So Kathy was actually dead by 4:15 a.m. And she was not wearing any makeup or jewelry that she had left the house in, and she'd been strangled. She also had a broken nose and a blackened eye, almost like a husband beating the crap out of his wife. Just conjecture here. So there was blood on her underwear, but not on her outer clothes. And this is when I first started thinking maybe she was raped.
Yeah, that's so what I thought. The first thing I thought, of course, I didn't think menstrual blood because as a male, we forget about that over and over again.
Yeah,
but
for sure.
It could also be that. But I definitely think that there was some form of, maybe it was both, but I definitely think she was raped.
And this is 1997. I know that we are not going to be like as politically correct as we are now, but I felt like they were really painting her to kind of be slutty.
Yeah, me too.
And I thought that was unfair.
Loose, yeah.
Yeah, which is like, okay, well, she was possibly raped, so maybe let's not just say she was a big old slut. But anyway, so Mosley, the detective guy who got in trouble, said that she was obviously killed somewhere else, cleaned up, and put into her vehicle. Now, Robert Stack comes on and says, shortly before she died, Kathy had engaged in sexual activity.
When he says that, it makes me uncomfortable. Yeah. It's like listening to my grandpa talk about it.
Oh, see, I don't mind him talking about sexual activity, but I don't like sexual activity plus blood, and we're going to say that she had sex. Like, no, blood plus quote-unquote sexual activity usually means rape.
Right, and the whole thing is questionable. You know, it's one of those things where it also, if they really wanted to go that route, they could have thrown in, it's possible she had, you know, her period at the period of time.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, I don't know why they were so hesitant to talk about rape on this episode. We have definitely talked about rape before, but they completely left out the part that Brooke Baker was raped. Yeah. They never even said that once.
I have a feeling, I mean, I'm probably wrong here, but I feel like there was a moratorium on the word rape for this particular segment.
It was shocking that they didn't say it. Like this is a big part of the
story. They've said rape. They've called out rape before, you know, in other segments. But this one, it was a glaring, glaring omission of the word.
Exactly. And like, they were kind of painting her to be a loose woman. So police found out that she hadn't met Charlotte and that she actually went to go have like a romantic night with her new boyfriend in a Beaumont hotel motel. And they interview the boyfriend. We never know his name or anything, but they interview the boyfriend and he says that, yeah, they made love that night, but yeah, it was all on the up and up. So in the autopsy, they found that the quote unquote sex partner, had a vasectomy, but her boyfriend didn't. But you know who did have a vasectomy recently is Steve, her
Lefty
husband.
Lefty Steve.
Yeah, and they go, so they literally say, so that means Kathy must have had sex that night with someone else.
But then we get his story, and it's the creepiest story to date.
Oh, he's the worst.
Like, I was really waiting for him to get caught or something. But when he talks about how she comes out of the shower and you would think like all of a sudden things were romantic between them, but no, they were separate. I don't know if they were divorced, but they were at least separated.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you were there to watch the kids so she can go out and actually have fun with her friend. And it's not going to end in a romantic situation. It just isn't. You know?
And he says that they just like impromptu had sex on the living room floor. Now, if you're a married person with two small kids that could come out at any time having sex, I mean, I would think that you would do it in your bedroom. I mean,
it's over once you have kids.
No, no. But I mean, you're not having sex in the middle of a common area, I would imagine, once you have kids. But
I think, I mean, was it thrown out there to just kind of also say that she's the spontaneous wild woman?
Yeah.
Who knows
she
what
is
she
just
does?
Insatiable. Like, she is just ready to have sex at the drop of a dime, even with this guy that she hates. Like, oh my God.
Right.
So
watch out for the fish grease.
Oh my God. We'll get into some fish grease. But Sherry says that Sherry, the sister, says that Steve saw two phone numbers written down while he's at her house with nothing to do but snoop through all her stuff because he's a jealous ex-husband.
Steve's a pretty big guy, too. Would you say he seemed? I mean, he's just sitting there. He looks like a pretty built guy.
Stocky. And
yeah, but I mean, he looks like he's strong. That's what he looks like to me. Like he kind of has like a biker body.
Yeah, no doubt. So he sees these two phone numbers and he calls them because he's a jealous lunatic. And one was Charlotte's, but the other one was for the motel. And Sherry had actually told Charlotte before, like, if Steve calls, tell him I'm with you. I'm heading home, you know, because she knew that he was going to check up on her. Like when you're a kid sneaking out of the house and you say, here's my friend's number, you can check.
Yeah.
So basically, Kathy's family and I, and probably you, Mark, think that she came home, took a shower, which is why she wasn't wearing like makeup or jewelry. And he got enraged about the thought of her being with another man. And because it's a power thing, because she is leaving him, lest we forget, the most dangerous time in an abusive relationship is when the woman is leaving. He raped her and was like, beat her up, strangled her, and redressed her. And I can see this so perfectly in my mind's eye that I just know that this happened. I could see him raping her, being like, oh, you'll have sex with him, but you won't have sex with me. Like, and it's violent and it's angry. He's punching her. Like, I can picture this scenario so well in my head.
Yeah, and I think you're spot on. I mean, of course, we have no evidence to prove this, but scenario-wise, this is the scenario that makes sense, I think, to both of us.
Yeah, absolutely. But who does Steve say is responsible for all this?
The Beaumont Mafia.
Yeah, he says there's a bunch of Italians around here, and I think they wanted to kill me and her. And
so who's the Italian?
I know. He called it literally the Beaumont Mafia. And I've been to Beaumont, Texas. I don't think there's a Beaumont Mafia. So
there's a pizzeria. That's about it.
Yeah. Well, here's the circumstantial evidence that I've gathered against Steve.
Okay? Well, let me just – I just want to ask one thing, though. Now, we know that he had a little bit of an in with the police, right? Again, that's not a Hummer. That is a Gardner. my window's open because I'm in the attic and it's hot as hell up here. And as a New Yorker, it's 75 degrees and it's very warm. I'm just getting used to the temperature change. All right, that aside, is it possible, like, he was part of this Beaumont Mafia of, like, maybe six people who would, like, you know, it seems like he had some level of an in with some organized something. I mean, it just seems, if there is a Beaumont Mafia, he's a part of that.
If there is a Beaumont Mafia, yeah, I'm maybe that's what he calls himself and like a bunch of his guy friends. Like, yeah, we're the Beaumont Mafia. But the thing is that, you know, Occam's Razor, the most simple scenario is usually what happened. Like, I don't think there is a Beaumont Mafia. I think he's totally trying to throw it off. He's throwing like a whole ethnicity down with it.
Yeah. Now, you have you dug up some evidence and you put it together in a way that makes it a little bit more clear.
Yeah, so I read through the civil court trials. Like, I read verbatim every single thing that happened in the civil court trial. So here's what we have against Steve. This is all circumstantial, and this is all on the record. This isn't us projecting. So, A, he was abusive to her. He would grab her and push her, according to her sister, Sherry. When the officers came to his house to tell him that his wife was dead, he never turned the lights on, and they had asked him several times to turn the lights on.
What was his reason for not doing that?
I don't know. I think he's just like, what? I can't hear you over my fake crying. Like,
why couldn't they turn on the lights?
I don't know. Is that, I mean,
I don't know. I'm asking you questions that there's no way you could answer. It's just,
yeah,
it doesn't make sense to me. I mean, I guess.
I mean,
is that messing with the crime scene?
Yeah. And it's, I don't know if it's a crime because they don't consider it to be the crime scene, but it is his house. They don't have a search warrant. I don't think they're allowed to do anything. If you don't want the lights on and it's your own house, I don't think they can force you to turn the lights on. When they did shine a flashlight in his face because it was dark in there, they noticed that he had no tears coming down. The morning after all of this happened, according to her mother, he was seen, quote, vigorously washing clothing. And a store employee had also testified that Steve and one of his daughters had rented a carpet cleaner the next morning. He claims, all right. He claims that he missed garbage day, right? So he's walking out and he tumbles with this huge mayonnaise jar without a lid on it of, quote, fish grease.
What the hell's fish grease?
I shudder to think. It sounds disgusting. And so he says he spilled it all over, and that's why he had to get the carpet cleaner. So he...
Oh, there you go.
Right? It totally checks out. So he cleans it up, cleaning vigorously. Him, his sister-in-law, and his mother were all seen cleaning this carpet. And then the next day, they had like a burn barrel in the backyard where they burned all the towels from the quote-unquote fish grease.
I would, I mean, if I spilled fish grease in my house, I'm assuming I know what fish grease would smell like. I would just throw out the whole rug. There's no coming back from that. But of course, this is to cover some form of DNA evidence.
Exactly. Or if it's blood. I mean, you'd think you'd
right.
cut it all out. So more incriminating. He was seen walking away from the ditch the morning that Kathy was discovered.
Unbelievable.
He, this jerk, desecrates her grave repeatedly. In fact, he is even convicted of it in 1995.
Now, how is he desecrating it? Is he like vandalizing it, knocking it over?
Kicking like flowers and stuff there. Like he would kick her grave is such that it has like a vase built into it. And yeah. I guess he would like break that, kick it, freak out. And so her parents, who are like very into this,
yes.
Getting justice for her, they had actually set up a camera because they noticed that somebody was doing it and they had him on camera. So that's why he was convicted of it in 1995.
Now, here's the thing that I think is always strange about this, and this is to get a little bit spiritual as well. Now, a lot of people who do these type of heinous crimes, they might not even believe that there is a God or an afterlife, you know, and I'm not trying to change anybody's mind on that, but you would think, well, you killed this person. You've done probably the worst thing that a person can do, taking someone else's life. You are going to hell, I guess. Like that would be the, I guess, Christian belief. So where is his mind at that he's going to make it even worse by going and like, what's he trying to accomplish by going and messing with the grave?
Well, there is a huge pissing match, for lack of a better term, between her father and him. Yeah. Like, her father knows in his mind that Steve did this. And so the part where we come to Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri, is that her dad put three billboards that said, like, welcome to Orange County, Texas, where you can kill your wife and get away with it. And then had a picture of Steve with a sign on it that said murderer. And it says like, Steve Page raped and murdered my daughter. I believe that the Vidor police took a bribe from him, like all these different things. So he like bought space right along the interstate and put those signs up. And so Steve says every day when he's like driving his daughters to school, they see those signs, you know, and it was really traumatizing. So they move, but it seems like there's a big competition between the two. But more along the circumstantial side, just to finish this out, Steve is actually left-handed, and we find out that she was strangled by someone who was left-handed. He didn't want Kathy to be autopsied. He told every one of her family members that he was afraid to have police in the house because they would find Kathy's blood from where she had cut herself shaving.
So convenient. It's always very convenient when this blood keeps showing up.
I know, isn't it? Oh, my gosh. So Kathy's mom said that the morning that Kathy was found, Steve had the scratches on his face. And then Steve, we were talking about like talking smack about your dead wife. He tells everybody that she was using cocaine and drinking and driving and also using Valium. And that's why she crashed. And she did test positive for Valium, but she had a prescription for it. And she tested negative for cocaine or for alcohol. So Steve also, as late as like 2013, says that he is too busy to remember his murdered wife, Kathy. And there's a Daily Mail article where he just continually brags about having like such a younger, hotter girlfriend.
Oh my God. It's like, he's who's he bragging to, you know?
I know. It's crazy. So we do have an update. It's never solved, but he's still considered a person of interest. Now, Kathy's family won a wrongful death civil suit against him. And they found, a jury found that Stephen Page did kill Kathy Page and awarded damages of $200,000 to Kathy's parents and their minor child, Monica.
But he never went to prison.
No, but it's a civil trial. Mm. It's not a criminal trial. Now, the difference between a civil trial and a criminal trial is that you have to have beyond a reasonable doubt. We've all heard that with the criminal trial. With a civil trial, you only have to be 51% or more sure that he did it.
It's just, so, it's so strange to me that, you know, they're awarding this, you know, this money based upon the fact that he's guilty of murder, which is a criminal offense, of course.
Oh,
it's just, that he's not going to be convicted as a murderer.
It's the same exact thing that happened with OJ. Like, OJ was set free, you know, or was found not guilty. And then Ron Goldman's dad actually sued him civilly, and he was found responsible in a wrongful death trial.
Four so words. Five. The glove did not fit.
Yeah, you must acquit. So from the civil suit, we learned that Detective Mosley had actually known Steve Page for his whole life. And I'll post a link to the civil suit in its entirety because it's really juicy. But their youngest daughter, Monica, had to testify against her father that she think that he killed the mom at the trial.
And how old was she at the time?
I don't know how old she was at the time. That's a good question. But she was 7 at the time her mom was murdered. I don't know how old she was when she had to testify against her dad. They had 2 daughters. One daughter was like vehemently on the dad's side, and one was like vehemently on dad's side.
It's tearing a family apart. I mean, it's disgusting. Yeah.
And sadly, at the age of 27 in 2011, poor little Monica died of a prescription drug overdose. They classify it as a suicide. So I'm sure that thinking, whether it's true or not, I personally believe it's true, thinking that her dad murdered her mom and then having to testify against it and see these billboards every day. Like, I'm sure it all did a huge number on her mental well-being.
Yeah, absolutely. I couldn't. I just really pity that entire situation, the family, and all because of a jealous husband, mostly.
Yeah, that's a tale as old as time.
Do you think that the scenario was, because the guy just seems to me to have some level of substance abuse, to be making these kind of rash things happen, right? Or maybe he's just a rager. I don't know. But
yeah,
he definitely set up his ex-wife to be in this car accident, and he was too stupid to like get it to actually happen.
Yeah. I don't know. I wouldn't say substance abuse, that just my red flags didn't go off for that. I just think he's a cocky jerk that thinks he can get away with that. This is what I say, so this is the truth.
Yeah. I just think that part of this, you know, seems like he can pull it together and get through a few sentences. And then there's this other side of him. And I'm just wondering what causes this separation to happen. And that's why I usually will go to some level of substance abuse.
That makes sense.
I could be totally wrong. Maybe the guy could just click it on, click it off. I mean, clearly he has a lot of mental issues. Even if he's completely innocent, the way he's dealing with the death of the mother of his children, and this whole thing causing his daughter to take her own life, it's clearly affecting, it doesn't affect him in the way that it would affect you or me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Like, we're definitely much more sympathetic than it seems he is.
Yeah. Oh, no, he's the worst. Yeah, he's the worst. But it's weird that they kind of bury that story in the middle, because I think that's like the crux of this whole episode. But we do end up with two short little, quick little stories. So we're in Ocala, Florida. It's 1995, early in the morning. 48-year-old Wilma Drew is driving, and a car heads head on at her in the wrong direction, going 55 miles an hour in the wrong direction.
It's our worst fear, right? It's just the worst.
Yeah. I don't even have that fear. It's so out of like the realm of what should be happening. Like, that is so crazy.
Although driving back from Buffalo or something like that, Niagara Falls last year, we drove at least 55 miles. I said 55 just because it's in front of me, but about like 40 to 60 miles on a 2-lane road that you had to be traveling at least 80 to 90 miles. And you would be going practically head on with tractor trailers on the other side. And the whole time, it was just 2 lanes. One way, and the other. And it was horrifying.
Yeah, I'll bet. With a bunch of Boy Scouts in tow.
No, it was just us, but it was like mountainside. And with no guardrails on the side.
Oh, my God.
So you can't even, like, have a panic attack and pull over, and it was a big rainstorm. All right, anyway. So it's always my fear that this is going to happen to me.
Yeah, that is really stressful.
Yes.
David Vitito is actually right behind Wilma at the time of the incident. And so they hit head on, and we'll show you a picture of the car. Like, this is like,
it's so much worse than I could have imagined.
Yeah, absolutely. It's like, it's literally like you smashed a can. Like,
this is why you wear a seatbelt.
Yeah. So David runs for help. He sees that the passenger and the driver in the wrong way car were moving, but Wilma isn't. Now, we never get into why they were on the wrong side of the road or anything like that, but we do see poor Wilma is pinned with the steering column against her chest, and her head is like completely slumped over. So her driver's window's down, but the other windows are all jammed. So Matthew White, this other guy, hops in to help. And her neck is broken so much so, like, a complete vertebrae is gone now. They call it the hangman's break because
it's cringy. It's like, oh, my God.
It's so ominous. But it had completely broken. It's the same thing that happens when you drop in the gallows and your neck breaks. Her neck was broken, and because it was slumped over in such an unnatural position, it had completely cut off her airway, and she was just, like, slowly suffocating to death. So this mysterious tanker truck stops, and he happens to have a pickaxe on him. So I have a feeling he's seen some things, but they busted the window. He climbs in behind Wilma and does what you're probably not supposed to do and, like, just starts jostling her head. He, like, picks it up. And he picks it up very smoothly. He's not jostling it, but I know you're not supposed to mess with head injuries. So,
yeah. I would imagine the body would be convulsing a little bit as you're suffocating.
Yeah.
And that's why I'm thinking. But yeah, what he did is he lifts the head and I'm assuming what he heard is her take a breath. And yeah, then he's like, oh, my God, if I can't move because of blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, my God, this guy is literally has. And I think they even said it had her life in his hands. Literally.
Yeah, absolutely. It's 10 minutes until the ambulance arrives. And he is sitting there, like, completely still holding her head, almost like against the headrest of the seat just to stabilize it. Yes. So paramedics are like, sir, we need you to get out of the car. And he's like, I'll help you. I'll get out as soon as you stabilize their neck. And they're like, no, just, like, let go of her, let it drop, and we'll get in there and do our job. And he's like, I will only get out of the car if somebody holds her head in place until you get it stabilized.
Yeah.
So Matthew, one of the guys that helped before, holds her head still, and the truck driver just leaves. No thank you, no recognition, no nothing. He just leaves, like, just another day.
Now, what did you think the explanation was going to be? Because I can tell you what I thought because of where the paranormal story was.
For him leaving?
Yeah. Like, what did you think that the explanation that Unsolved Mystery was going to present?
Guardian angel.
Right. It was going to be an angel story. Like, nobody had even seen a truck on that, you know, thing. Or, you know, or trucks weren't even allowed on that road.
I love that. Yeah.
But, yeah, but it wasn't. But in reality, it was a really wonderful, wonderful truck driver who happened, thank God, to have the knowledge. He was a former EMT.
Yeah, we find out later he was.
It's amazing. I mean, it's really amazing, perfectly timed, and sometimes things just kind of work out. They show a picture of her in the hospital, which is crazy.
She had 11 surgeries, and after 1 year, she is, like, just beginning to, like, relearn how to walk and stuff. She has permanent double vision from the head trauma that she suffered.
I'll take Bill it. Drew,
I guess. I mean, yeah, I will too. I will too. But it seems really annoying. So
close one eye. That's all, I guess.
Bill Drew, her husband.
I'm making fun, but I would. That's all. I'm just saying it.
Yeah. No, totally. Totally. So her husband stumbles upon the accident, saw it, thought she was dead. And they're just, like, talking to Unsolved Mysteries. And they're like, oh, my gosh, you know, I'm so lucky to be alive. I'm so glad to have my wife. So she says she's not even angry. She just considers herself to be really lucky and that she just wants to thank this guy. They both want to thank the guy.
Yeah.
So after seeing the show, the truck driver called into the telecenter and he called Wilma, but he doesn't come forward and get recorded because he's just a good person. Like, he doesn't want recognition for this. He just wanted to talk to her.
What a jerk. No, I love him. He should get an award for this. I mean, or at least just be known as somebody who was literally somebody's lifesaver, literally.
Yeah, totally. And, you know, Bill and Wilma are both still around. I've been Facebook stalking them. They seem to be very happy to be recent grandparents, and they're just living a good life.
Now, this next story, I'm going to fully admit, I watched 3 or 4 times, and I just don't get it. Like, I don't want to go down my own personal rabbit holes, and I wanted to know if you could just tell this story, because I had a hard time even understanding what they're trying to get through here. It just seems to be people who moved away from each other.
Okay, happy to help.
All right.
So Stella Hutt is getting married and she just wishes her mom was there. She basically only grew up with a single father, Robert Wortman, and he has raised her on her own since she was 3 years old. Stella's mother actually disappeared in 1975. So we go back a little way, 1972. Stella's father is serving in the Air Force in Seoul, South Korea, and he is an African-American man, and he falls in love with a South Korean woman. And the only reason that that I even bring that up is because she talks about her like journey being biracial and not fitting in and stuff. So he meets and falls in love with Oak Cha, who he calls Sunny. Now, they married and had a baby, little baby Stella, and they relocated because of him being in the Air Force. They relocated to Tokyo, Japan.
By the way, Sunny is one of those things where it's like, Cindy, I don't know why, and I don't think this is racist or anything, but it seems to be, I know so many Asian girls whose nicknames are Cindy or Sunny, and I don't know why. And they're just nicknames. No, you know.
Yeah.
All right, sorry.
So all Stella remembers is that her mom worked at an ice cream parlor when she was little, and she also worked nights as a waitress. So Robert tells little baby Stella that her mom fell in with the wrong crowd and people who, quote, weren't very family oriented. So they decide to send Stella to move to New Jersey to live with Robert's mom because they're having marital issues and they're like, we're going to be doing some fighting, I'm guessing. So why don't you go to New Jersey with your grandma and we'll meet you here later.
From Japan.
Yeah, from Japan. And granted, she's like three at the time, so it's probably not as big of an adjustment for her. But I'm sure there's still some culture shock. So he leaves her there and returns to, quote, work on his marriage with Oak Cha. And they, as a family, were granted a transfer to New Jersey. So Sunny says, before I go to New Jersey, you go on ahead. I need to go see my family in South Korea one last time before we move. So that's it. That's the last time they see her. They never, ever see her again. Robert eventually remarried and had another daughter. But Stella, the stepmom's a different race than Stella is. So she said, like, I always knew I was kind of on the outs and I was just different. My stepmom was great, but I knew I wasn't her kid. So in 1985, when Stella's like 12 or 13 years old, she receives a surprise package that she thinks is from Sunny. I don't know why, but it's postmarked from California and there's a stuffed animal in there and four dresses. And she is obsessed with the stuffed animal. She has to sleep with it every night. She never wants to be apart from it because it's something from her mom.
Of course, yeah.
And she actually wants, she's on here now because she has a child named Darius and she wants her mom to meet her son now. And she's like, it's not too late. We can still figure this out, you know? And that's where we ended. There's absolutely no update. Nobody's ever heard from Sunny. And I don't even know how responsible this is to say on the air. But just putting my little Unsolved Mysteries detective cap on, is it possible that Robert had something to do with her disappearance?
Oh, you think there's something nefarious?
It's possible. He dropped her off and went back to see the mom. And ever since the mom and him were having a big tumultuous argument about ending their relationship, then she's never seen from again. The package is postmarked from California, but there's no reason why Sunny would be in California. And you know how they say about bad-mouthing your missing wife? He said, like, she was falling with the bad crowd. She wasn't family-oriented, all this stuff. So this is just ticking all these red flags for me. And, again, I hate to even say something like that because worst-case scenario or best-case scenario, this guy is a grieving husband who heroically stepped up to be the only person in his daughter's life. But I think we got to consider that as a possibility.
Yeah, I think that it's a nice story. I think it's a non-story, unless there's more to it. Now, the only thing that really bothered me about this segment was when Stella's referring to herself as half Oriental.
I know.
I've never, ever heard somebody who's Asian refer to themselves as Oriental. And if you don't know this, you know, you know this, but if people are listening, they don't know this. This is a very not PC term. Oriental things are like rugs and lamps. They're objects. They're physical things. They're not people. So it's the proper term is Asian.
Do you think that that could possibly be some like inward self-hatred? Yes, because she hates the Asian side of her family?
No, I think the way she was raised is that those Orientals, maybe, which kind of goes in line with what you're talking about. I hope I'm wrong because I know that I know quite a few Asian people who genuinely hate that. And, you know, it happens more and more. It happened more and more in the 70s and stuff like that.
Exactly.
not so much now. So even this episode, which aired in the late 90s, it was kind of jarring to hear it.
Yeah. Oh, totally. And I found her on Facebook, and she is like one of the most beautiful women I've ever seen in my life.
She's I showed her to my wife, and she's like, "Oh my God, I think she's on America's Next Top Model." And I'm like,
"She's
beautiful." Know. I mean,
maybe. But she is on her Facebook, like really, really embracing her South Korean side of her ethnicity.
Yeah.
Her son is happy and healthy. She is happy and healthy. She's remarried. She's got two beautiful daughters now with a new husband. And like, she seems like she has a great life, but I see absolutely no sign that she has ever reconnected with her mom.
Now, whenever you dig up these Facebook things, I click every single one in the hope that I have a common friend.
Oh, that'd be
it's yet to happen. Yet to happen. One day we can hope.
We are at the very beginning of our Unsolved Mysteries journey. So one day.
that would be really kind of crazy just to, you know, kind of go down that rabbit hole and see who knows who.
Mm-hmm.
But Kim, as always, thank you very much for doing this. We're actually recording another little segment right now with a fellow internet sleuther.
Mm-hmm.
So that's something I guess will get released before this episode probably.
Yeah.
So I shouldn't have even brought it up, but thank you very much for doing all of the work that you do. Best time of the week for me is doing this show.
Same, same. I'm just happy we're doing it together. Thank you.
And if you're listening to the show and you enjoy it, please leave us a review. Come and check us out on Facebook. Look for us, Unsolved Mysteries Rewind. Post pictures, questions, memes, whatever you got. We appreciate it.
Totally.
Tonight, we have been confronted with an entire catalog of unexplained and unsolved events. Tune in next time as Unsolved Mysteries Rewind discusses another collection of unsolved mysteries. Until then, we can only look and wonder.